Ladies and gentlemen, we are ready to start the program now. Professor Rangan, who is the director of the institute, he said that he will not be able to join us this evening because he was quite hectically involved in the satellite launch which went off yesterday. So he's quite tired. And so he has asked me to conduct today's evening program. And you all know that we are having this Research Associates program for the last several years. And today we have a very distinguished guest who has come for our program here on a workshop on nature and culture. It's going on since yesterday morning, organized by Professor Narasimha. And I think it would be in the fitness of things that if he introduces Professor Fritz.
Well, I want to welcome all of you, and in particular our speaker this evening, Professor Fritz Stahl. And it's a pleasure to introduce him to you. I actually met him only a few days ago, but we have known each other by email for quite some time. Because I have been one of those people who were struck by his writings. And some years ago, sent off a message to him asking some questions about what he had written, and since then we have basically been electronic friends till last week. Professor Stahl has had a very interesting career. He started in the University of Amsterdam, where he graduated with a degree in mathematics, physics and philosophy. He tells me that he strayed into philosophy because of a government fellowship that was available doing philosophy in India. So those government fellowships sometimes do some very interesting things. And so he came here and did a PhD at the University of Madras with Professor T.M.P. Mahadevan. Also spent a year at Banaras Hindu University with Professor T.V.R. Murthy, whom many of us will know for his work on Buddhism. And his son is a personal friend of I think most of us here. Well, during the time that he was in India, in those years, he travelled around the south on a motorbike, Royal Enfield, am I right? He got out of a Royal Enfield and travelled around the south making recordings of Vedic recitations, in particular in Kerala, Tamil Nadu, and I think in some other areas as well. And apparently he recorded some very unusual, until then unheard, recitations, on the basis of which he went to London, where he became a lecturer in Sanskrit at the School of Oriental and African Studies. Then he spent a couple of years at the University of Pennsylvania, 1 year, 2 years, and went back to Amsterdam as a professor in 1962 of general and comparative philosophy. He gave an inaugural address at Amsterdam, which I think is still the practice in European universities, that a new professor gives an inaugural address. And his theme was very similar to what he's speaking on today. And basically, he made the statement there in that lecture, what Euclid is to Europe, pardon me, is to India. Well, that lecture was given in Dutch, and I must thank him for giving me a copy of that lecture just now. I'm sorry, I have to switch this off. I forgot to switch it off, in spite of the instruction we have for everybody on the door there. But an English translation of it is available in a book called Universals, in which you will find some very other papers by him as well, essays on Sanskrit, logic, history of science in India, and other related subjects. In 1967, he went to the United States, was a visiting professor of linguistics at MIT, and then in 68, he became a professor of philosophy and of South Asian languages at the University of California at Berkeley. He's now an emeritus professor there, but he actually is trying to make his home in Thailand, which makes him fairly close to India now. So maybe we can see him more often now that he's not so far away. He has written a variety of books and essays which I consider very illuminating and provocative. He has two volumes called Agni, which are a recording in minute detail of a yajna performed in Kerala, a Vedic ritual of the fire altar, of the kind that we have here as a logo for this institute. And Mr. Bala Nambiar says he got the inspiration for that from attending that that yajna which was performed in Kerala. So it's two volumes which describe this Vedic ritual in minute detail. He has written extensively about many other subjects related to India, about Indian logic, about linguistics, about Sanskrit, about grammar, about Indian rituals, about concepts of science in Europe and Asia, mantras between fire and water. And just now, he's actually writing another book called The Kakhaga of the Vedas, okay, instead of the ABC. So that is something which I'm probably turning out later this year. He's also made a film called The Altar of Fire and has a record album on the four Vedas. Well, I have found him one of the truly insightful and illuminating observers of the Indian scene, in particular of our traditions, Vedic, scientific, cultural in many ways, mystical, and as you will find out very soon, he always has some interesting things to say. In relation to the theme that he had adopted in his inaugural address in Amsterdam, he has now added that last bit there, which is a question, Arade. So we look forward to hearing about his views 30 odd years after the first lecture was given. Professor Stock.
For your kind words. Ladies and gentlemen, friends, the topic of this evening is the thesis that Euclid is to Europe what Panini is to India. It is a baffling topic because it causes havoc. Can you understand me? It causes havoc to a widespread prejudice, the myth of the two cultures of sciences and humanities. The sciences, it is said, are exact and rigorous. The humanities seem to lack those qualities, and what they offer instead is not very clear. Since Euclid was a mathematician and therefore a scientist, he belonged to a species that is highly regarded, and for good reasons. Panini, on the other hand, was a grammarian or linguist, according to some a more marginal occupation. So must we accept the myth and draw the conclusion that Europe addressed basic and substantial issues, but India dabbled in trivialities? I hasten to add that I'm not attributing any belief in that outlandish myth of the two cultures to academic institutions such as the National Institute that has honored me with this invitation. Modern academia includes numerous recent disciplines that transcend such boundaries. I mention only the cognitive sciences and many that deal with information and communication. All the same, popular imagination adheres to the picture. And if you want money, especially in the United States, you better claim that what you are doing is science. I am therefore especially grateful and pleased that I am allowed to address the associates of a National Institute of Advanced Studies and not just sciences. Perhaps in the last resort, those studies are just sciences, since it is at least in part a matter of words and definitions. I'm very happy also that I'm in a position to visit Bangalore. It's not for the same reason as the Prime Minister of China, who preceded me in entering India at your cool and leafy city, spurning a red carpet arrival in New Delhi in order to delve into the heart of India's information technology and globalizing economy. Mr. Wen Jiabao did not come to announce my impending visit, and I shall not follow him and proceed to New Delhi, but return to Thailand. I spend much time in South India, but I do not know Bangalore well. I missed a rare chance to spend some years here, and if I had been able to do it, my Sanskrit would be better. As a graduate student of Advaita Vedanta at the University of Madras, I visited the Sringeri Matha, where I was introduced to the then Shankaracharya Jagat Guru Swami Abhinava Vidya Tirtha. He was quite young himself and was studying a difficult late Advaita text, the Varana Prameya Sangraha, by one of your fellow state men, Vidyaranya, under the tutelage of Pandita Raja V.S. Ramachandra Shastri of the Shankara Matha of your city. Among the other luminaries, all university professors, that Ramachandra Shastri was the only traditional Pandit member of the first Sanskrit Commission of the Government of India. He did not speak to me, but the Jagat Guru addressed me in Sanskrit, and must have noticed that I did not always get it. Having heard me stutter, His Holiness graciously suggested that I spend some years studying myself with that same great Pandit. But when I went back to the University of Madras, my professor did not like the idea, since I was a Government of India scholar, as you already heard. The government might not approve such a transition or approve it soon enough. And so I missed those golden opportunities to learn Sanskrit well and spend some years in Bangalore, for which I must now make up fast. But you came to hear about Euclid and Panini. So where were we? I was holding forth on the difference between the sciences and humanities, arguing that we should not make that distinction. I must now explain briefly, at least, how anyone could have come up with such a preposterous idea. It was the pet theory of a 19th century German philosopher, Wilhelm Dilthey. Dilthey was basically a historian and did not know much about what he called the natural sciences. His more famous colleague, Edmund Husserl, the founder of phenomenology, considered Dilthey chiefly as a man of genius for intuition, not of rigorous science and theory. Dilthey himself preferred to call the sciences of culture Geisteswissenschaften, or sciences of the spirit, even though no one knew or agreed on what a Geist or spirit was. Whatever it is, or precisely because of that aura of mystery, the idea about the distinction between sciences of nature and sciences of culture caught on as if with a vengeance. Then, a century later, Dilthey's ideas were rather unexpectedly supported by the British author and physicist C.P. Snow. It is he who introduced the phrase, the two cultures. Snow wrote several novels about scientists, but that does not mean that he knew anything about the science of literature, let alone the sciences of language. Just as an elephant, himself an animal, does not know anything about zoology, let alone the life sciences in general. And so we are left with a distinction between two things, A and B, based upon the ideas of two people, one who knew A but not B, the other B but not A. A shaky foundation. My conclusion is that we should not make sharp distinctions between large groups of scientific disciplines. Yes, there are many, like pebbles on the beach, but they are not only painted in two colors, red and blue, or black and white, or whatever. If you want a substantial foundation on which to base this negative conclusion, you need only glance at the history of science. During the European Middle Ages, the distinction did not exist. Music, for example, was regarded as a science. If you look at China, India, or the Arab world, there is no trace of that distinction either. I conclude that we can only study the subject of this evening dispassionately if we accept a very flexible notion of the concept of science. I have found it fruitful to regard as science all forms of systematic knowledge of ourselves and the universe to which we belong. So let us try to turn to Euclid with an open mind. It's not known where he was born, but he was probably taught geometry at Athens by pupils of Plato, and he taught him and founded himself a school at Alexandria. His famous Elements, which were written around 300 BC, are a systematic treatise on geometry. He may not have been a great mathematician, like some other ancient Greeks, and has been called an excellent schoolmaster. The Elements are indeed a textbook that incorporates many theorems that others had discovered before him. But I believe that he was more than a schoolmaster because his axiomatic method was new and has so far lasted for almost 2.5 millennia. Of course, few things are totally new. Euclid's text starts with what he calls common notions, a concept that comes from Aristotle, Plato's star pupil. Common notions are what we now call axioms. Let us take a look at an example. Things which are equal to the same thing are also equal to each other. It means that if, for instance, 3 plus 2 equals 5, and 7 minus 2 also equals 5, then it follows that 3 plus 2 and 7 minus 2 are equal to each other. But Euclid was not primarily thinking of numbers. He was thinking of lines or line segments. His work is first and foremost about geometry, though it includes some chapters on numbers. In both areas, his innovation and great contribution was to prove or demonstrate mathematical propositions by deriving them from axioms. Let us look briefly at one of his propositions. It is not formulated as a statement, as you might expect, but as a construction, and it says, I quote, "To draw a straight line at right angles to a given straight line from a given point on it." To draw a straight line at right angles on a given straight line from a point on it. The demonstration starts with the sentence, "Let A be the given straight line and C the given point on it." This is accompanied by a figure which depicts a triangle that stands on the line. In the printed editions of translations of the Elements, these points are marked A, B, C, D, and so on. In the medieval manuscripts, they are indicated by the letters of the Greek alphabet, alpha, beta, gamma, and so on. The proof ends with QED, or rather the Greek equivalent of the Latin quod est demonstrandum, what is what had to be demonstrated. You must not rush to the conclusion that all propositions are constructions. Following Aristotle, Euclid distinguished not only propositions from common notions or axioms. He also introduced other concepts such as hypotheses, postulates, and other terms or ideas that he did not always use clearly or even consistently, and that specialists continue to discuss. I therefore propose to leave it at that. But you need to know one more thing. Euclid paid much attention to definitions. They are actually quite nice to quote. The first is, "A point is that which has no part." The second, "A line is breadthless length." And so on it goes. What were Euclid's shortcomings? There is, of course, a celebrated one, the fifth postulate. The formulation of that postulate by Euclid is very complex, so I shall replace it by a simple approximation. Euclid wrote something like, I quote, "Through a point outside a line, you can draw only one line that is parallel to the first." That proposition defines flat geometry. It does not apply to the surface of a tennis ball, let alone a mango, and it was ousted by the discovery of curved spaces in many dimensions, first in geometry and then in physics and cosmology, where they are now used more or less as playthings. Implicit in the fifth postulate is a deeper and more interesting misconception. The idea that everything in the universe, including ourselves, must be evident to us. It is, of course, a preposterous claim. How presumptuous on our part. We as humans are part of the universe. But why should we have been selected in order to understand it or even evolved in that direction? I'm not quite finished with Euclid. He may have been refuted here or there, But he also demonstrated many things that are simply true. One of them is the so-called theorem of Pythagoras. It is not something that humanity owes to Euclid or some other Greek. It is well known that such theorems are also found in China and India. In India, that particular theorem is often and with equal justification called the theorem of Baudhayana, and that Baudhayana is someone to whom we shall return. Thousands or more such theorems have their place in what is now called modern science, coming from mathematics but also from some other sources, and illustrate in passing that modern science is not simply a product of the European scientific revolution, but that the way was paved by the earlier history of ancient and medieval science. That history can only be adequately understood if the Eurasian continent is treated as an undivided unit. During that period, the sciences of the Babylonians, Indians, Chinese, Greeks, and Arabs were all in contact with each other. It doesn't follow that Pythagoras, Baudhayana, and the Chobei, the Chinese text that has that same theorem, it doesn't follow that they borrowed from each other. It would be enough for there to have been some influences or perhaps borrowings in the area of geometry one would have left to the other, and it is a topic that deserves serious investigation. If, incidentally, you don't believe that that famous and multinational theorem is true, you better give a reason. The best reason is to prove that it is false. It will not earn you a Nobel Prize, but you may end up with the Field Medal in Mathematics, which is its equivalent in that science. I conclude that Euclid's legacy is the axiomatic method, which does not belong to Europe, but to modern science, and therefore to the world. It does not follow that it is the only way of doing mathematics. We are now in a position to make a momentous leap and jump to Isaac Newton, the paragon of modern science, though he regarded himself, like some of his colleagues, as a natural philosopher. Newton's Principia follows Euclid's method entirely and in all details. He derives propositions from axioms. He accompanies each proposition with a picture, and he ends with QED. But his subject matter is different. He adds what were later regarded as physical entities, such as force. It was a topic about which Aristotle had already speculated, but in the 17th century, the discussion about force was infused with new life by philosophers such as Descartes and Leibniz, who were better informed about the world. Both these thinkers went beyond Newton in matters of method. The reason is that they made use of the language of algebra. There was no algebra among the Greeks, and there was no algebra in Euclid. Descartes founded what is now called analytical geometry, which establishes a relationship between geometrical figures and algebraic expressions. Leibniz created the largest number of symbolic expressions and notations that are still in use today. As for Newton, he sometimes wrote equations, for example, to express infinite series, but he formulated his most famous laws in Latin, which was not always clear. Formulas such as F equals M times A, which we are now taught in school, were created by later mathematicians such as Euler. It is true that we today can easily read them into Newton's Latin, but we do so by hindsight. Many of the great philosophers and mathematicians, the natural philosophers of the 17th century, including Newton and Descartes, preferred the geometry of the ancients, that is Euclid's Elements, to what they call the mathematics of the moderns, which was algebra. At the same time, most of them, except Leibniz, regarded that algebra as a barbaric art. The case of Descartes is remarkable and paradoxical because he had himself established a link between geometry and algebra. The dislike of algebra may be due to the fact that it had been introduced by aliens, paradesis, in the first place the Arabs, who did not only use what they had inherited from ancient Mesopotamia, India, and China, but made substantial new additions and contributions. The ambivalence about algebraic expressions of the 17th century had entirely disappeared one century later, when Lagrange, in his work on analytical mechanics, wrote the following: "I require neither constructions nor geometrical arguments, but only algebraic operations." And that still characterizes a lot of modern mathematics and physics. But now the case of Newton, the one that concerns us. It is the most interesting. He stood on the edge between old and new. Gravity demolished his view of flat space and turned out to be no force at all. It was replaced by a curvature of space-time in which all other particles and forces were subsequently housed. But Newton's view was a simple leftover of Euclid's parallel postulate with its implicit presumption. Newton stood at the end of the geometrical traditions in physics and hesitated to enter the new area of artificial languages. That is an important part of what the economist Maynard Keynes, a lifelong student of Newton, had in mind when he wrote that Newton, who incidentally was obsessed by alchemy throughout his life, that Newton was the last of the magi rather than the first modern physicist. We should not conclude that because of Newton, Euclid is now done with. There remains his axiomatic method, which was applied in many different contexts, not only in the so-called sciences. Spinoza, a kind of Advaitin, as you know, applied the art of demonstration from axioms to what he called ethics, a subject that covered a much wider area, but included what is nowadays called by that name. Whether such an approach is fruitful remains to be seen. Let us retrace our steps. Inspired by Aristotle, Euclid introduced the axiomatic method. He applied it to geometry and Newton extended it to physics. Its application to physics and the life sciences are still rather limited, but its application to logic and mathematics have been spectacular and have led to some of the most celebrated theorems of the last century. One of these is Gödel's incompleteness theorem. And there's a direct line, as you know, from Gödel to Alan Turing to computers. We are now ready to take another, not necessarily greater jump, and go to the second truncated half of the thesis that we are considering, namely, what is Panini to India? Looking at him from the Greek perspective, Panini did something that is tantalizingly similar to Euclid. He wrote a grammar of Sanskrit that starts, he composed a grammar of Sanskrit that starts with a list of syllables or sounds called the Shiva Sutra, from which all of his grammar can be logically derived. Did you hear my mistake? I said he wrote, but he didn't write, he composed. We come back to that. Since we are in India, I shall be brief about Panini's background. He was, roughly speaking, a contemporary of Euclid. It is a matter on which I expatiated yesterday during the discussion meeting on nature and culture that some of you may have attended. If I had to summarize what I said there and try to adapt it to our context, I would say the following. The background of Panini is the linguistic analysis of the Vedic Pratishakya treatises, which started with a discovery that was crucial to the canonization of the Vedas, Shakalya's fixation of the precise form of the Rig Veda. That took place one or two centuries before Panini and was the paradigm that the other three Vedas adopted, the decisive step that led to the canonization of what were subsequently referred as the four Vedas. In other words, that canonization was a process that took several centuries, many centuries in fact, and this was the end of it. But as for Panini, it shows that he did not start from scratch. But he was more innovative than Euclid. His grammar incorporated what his predecessors had done, but it revolutionized the science of language. He did not compose separate treatises on the languages of the different schools or shakhas of the Veda, like the Pratishakyas themselves, and from which they derived their name, Pratishakya, one for each shakha or school. Panini wrote a totally different kind of grammar for the spoken language of his day, and thereby laid the foundation for classical Sanskrit as well as modern linguistics. If you contrast the discovery of Shakalya, or Vidakta Shakalya, clever Shakalya, as he was called, with Panini's Shiva Sutra, you are in a position to appreciate how Panini turned the science of language upside down. There are, in fact, several stages or steps to it, and I illustrate one of them here. The authors of the Pratishakyas made, and the reciters of the Veda made this discovery, which to you should be quite clear. They produced a square, which you can either start from left to right or from top to bottom, ka-kha-ga-ga-nga, or ka-cha-ta-ta-pa. And they called it a varga. To this they added the vowels and diphthongs a, a, I, e, u, u, r, r, l, e, o, I, and au. You do the same in Kannada insofar as I have been able to find out. If I had to summarize what the composers of the Pratishakyas contributed to linguistics, I would say they discovered the natural order of the sounds of language, any language, as articulated in the mouth and the surrounding regions, moving from the larynx to the lips, unvoiced to voiced, non-aspirate to aspirate, and so on. I think that to a modern Indian that insight is still obvious, but the Vedic analysis of the sounds of language was a major discovery and a contribution that seems to have been made only once in world history. It was adopted by most of the languages of India and adopted or adapted by many other languages and scripts. Panini was, of course, familiar with these achievements. And I think you probably know those things. Is that so? That is still very, very obvious. This is what Panini did. His Shiva Sutra starts A-I-Um, R-Luk, A-Om, I-Ouch. It is strange, but not yet startling. He continues with semi-vowels and then comes to the consonants I mentioned just now. They are listed as nyamangananam. I marked the retroflexus murdhanya in my Roman transliteration with a dot underneath. I don't know whether you prefer to read the Roman or the Nagri, but I leave that to you. Nyamangananam, jabanye, gadhadash, Jabagarladash, Kapachatatachatav, Kapai, and so on. That is rather odd, to say the least. If you listen to what I want to do with you, I want to show you a little bit of how Panini really worked, rather than tell you a great deal about him. I think you already know how mathematics works a little bit and how physics works a little bit. You learn that in school. And there are some of you who, of course, know Panini much better than I do. But I think maybe for most of you, the associates of Nias, I don't know you. I have to hypothesize about what you know and what you like and what you want to. I think it would be much better to take a close look at a little bit of how Panini really works. And that means you have to look carefully. But there's nothing that you need to know more than what you saw on the previous illustration. Okay, if you listen and look at these enumerations carefully, you will find two strange deviations from what I have called the natural order of the sounds of language. First, Panini garbles or scrambles the order. And second, he puts in all kinds of other sounds. The latter can be easily recognized because they are consonants such as m, k, ch that are not followed by a short r. Moreover, I have in my recitation stopped after each of these letter sounds to make a boundary, and the written texts that are before you do the same by making use of vertical bars. I've given this list in Nagri and in Roman, simplifying a little, not only because I cannot do it in Kannada, but because the Roman has one practical advantage over the Indian scripts. It possesses capitals. I have used them to mark the sounds that are not followed by a short R more clearly. European and American scholars have assumed, as a matter of course, that Panini's grammar was composed in writing, and I made that same mistake a moment ago, but I consider that extremely unlikely. As for the earlier analysis of the Vedic treatises, it was not only about the mouth, but it was certainly done orally, not merely because it belonged to a strictly oral tradition, but because the art of writing had not yet been invented or imported from elsewhere. We may go one step further. The natural order of the sounds of language was discovered not despite the absence of writing, but because of it. Panini does refer to writing. That is, he was familiar with the fact that some people write. He was born, after all, in Shalatura, near Attock, on the Indus, where the Kabul River joins the Indus just before it enters the Punjab, an area that was then part of the Achaemenid Empire, where several kinds of writings had been known for a long time, and where the Aramaic script was commonly used for administrative and commercial purposes. Panini was a great scientist, and he had of course heard of, and may even have been familiar with some shapes or features of that Aramaic script. But he was also a Vedic Brahmin, and that is one reason for assuming that he composed his grammar orally. In Europe, Japan, or the United States, I must tell an audience that the ancient Indians did everything orally, which to them is astounding, but to you is nothing new. For me, it is in fact a stumbling block. The pandits from whom I must learn what I want to know everything by heart. They rattle off their Sanskrit at a speed that I do not only fail to comprehend, I can barely follow it. I am sometimes regarded as a specialist in oral traditions, but unfortunately, I myself have to look up everything in books and papers. Back to the Shiva Sutra. It has been called by that name. Of course, this is not the complete Shiva Sutra. I just picked out a few parts of it. It has been called by that name at a much later time, closer to the Bhakti period in India, and perhaps in order to suggest that it was revealed by the god Shiva. I have retained that attractive appellation, but at Panini's time, and for many centuries thereafter, that initial list was called Pratyahara Sutrani, the rules of condensation, Pratyahara, or Akshara Samamnaya, the enumeration of syllables. I must now account for its two strange deviations from what I have called the natural order of the sounds of language. Both can be explained by introducing the concept of Pratyahara, or condensation, that I have just mentioned. Panini condenses a set of sounds because he needs them, and only them, only those sounds, for the statement of one of his grammatical rules. That was a momentous innovation and was expressed by means of two equally great innovations: the use of metalinguistic markers and the use of meta-rules, which are rules about rules in Sanskrit, Paribhasha. The latter concept probably antedates Panini, as we shall see. I'm able to explain these two concepts together because the consonants followed by a short R are metalinguistic markers. So, N, K, N, Ch, T, all those strange things, they are metalinguistic markers. They belong to the grammar, but not to the object of the grammar, which was the Sanskrit language. A, I, U, R, L, A, O. So he wants a metalinguistic element to refer to something of the language itself. And that use is explained by a meta rule. a rule about how to use the rules of his grammar, and he has many of those. And that meta rule is the following. An initial sound joined to a final metalinguistic marker denotes the intervening sounds as well. An initial sound joined to a final metalinguistic marker denotes the intervening sounds as well. Now, if I had a stick or something like that, there we are. Vowels are often replaced by semi-vowels at the end of a word when followed by a short a. For instance, dadi, atra, milk, here, becomes Sanskrit metalinguistically. So in the place of, he uses a genitive, dvitiya. The main thing that he substitutes, he uses a nominative, so no ending or there may be an ending. When followed by something, he uses a locative, saptami, and so on. So actually, this ik is replaced by yan when ach follows, becomes ikaha, yan, achaha. And since it is itself, that metalinguistic statement, that meta rule, is subject to the rules of Sandhi and Sanskrit, it becomes iko yan achi. Now there you have a formula or a rule or a sutra of Pālini's grammar. And I shall not go on in that way, but if you do that for a couple of years, then you know Pālini's grammar. So this iko yana chi is an expression of an artificial language, and it resembles a formula. And it was shown, what I have already referred to or hinted at, by Paul Kiparsky, who worked at MIT with Chomsky and at Pune with S.D. Joshi, that Panini introduces these abbreviatory conventions into his meta-language if and only if they make it possible to bring out significant generalizations in the grammar. So what is a grammar? It must give generalizations, and I come back to that. Economy, lagava, in other words, is Panini's way of achieving generalization. It's a long demonstration, and it provides a rational explanation for the popular maxim that grammarians rejoice over the saving of half a syllable as over the birth of a son. You may have heard it, ardhamatra lagavena putrotsavam manyante vayakarna. I have a few more things to say about Panini before we shall change course and revert to the original thesis. First of all, Panini needed, like Euclid, and as a matter of course, definitions. Even if they deal with simple things, as some definitions should, they are not simple and sometimes deeply embedded in the grammar. I like the definition of padam, or word, and gives you an idea of how Panini thinks. It basically says that a word is a nominal or a verbal form, that is to say, a noun or a verb. Panini defines both these categories in terms of their endings, since Sanskrit is, as you know, a language with a rich system of declensions, nominal declensions, and conjugations, verbal conjugations. The list endings of the nominal declensions are condensed and referred to as sup. P is again the metalinguistic marker. The list of endings of verbal conjugations are condensed and referred to as ting. Ng is again the metalinguistic marker, and T is the ending that you have in bhavati, gacchati, and so on. Now comes the definition of a word. A word is what ends in sup or ting, or in the original Sanskrit, sup ting antam padam. Quite as succinct and attractive, I think, as a point is that which has no part, and more importantly, an equally significant generalization about our world in which humans and their languages are included. And another thing is that it is an artificial expression, and that goes beyond Euclid. It is not merely stated in a natural language such as Sanskrit or Greek. Panini was probably the creator of the genre of sutra or rule, which was destined to have a great future in Sanskrit scientific and philosophic literature. It was later defined by Madhva in the 13th century, also one of your Karnataka. How do you call the inhabitants of Karnataka? Pardon? Karnataka. Did Madhva speak Kannada apart from Sanskrit? Now he said, Svalpaksharam Asamdigdam, and you may know that a sutra consists of few syllables. It's not open to doubt. It contains the essence. It is Vishvatomukham. It faces in all directions. It is Astobham. It has no stobas. You know, stobas are those things in the Samaveda. How. But a sutra shouldn't have things like that. No poetry in the sutra also. Anavadyam, it is flawless. That is sutram sutra vidho viduhu. That is what the people who know what sutras are, that is what they know. Since these sutras are generalizable in isolation, that is outside the system in which they function and play their role, they need to be explained. This led to other new forms of Sanskrit literature, in particular the genre of writing commentaries or bhasha, sub-commentaries, glosses, vritti, vartika, tika, and so on. All these works use expressions and linguistic conventions that are to some extent formalized and that have their counterparts in medieval Latin in Europe, though it is much less formalized than Indian linguistics or logic. As for the sutras themselves, Panini's grammar was not only the paradigm, though I had heard today that there are 8 kinds of paradigm, but I say it was not only the paradigm, but it remained the most perfect example. Panini permits himself an occasional joke. I know you have been waiting for it. Or perhaps pleasantry is a better term. One is the final rule of his grammar, which is ah. It is, like many other rules, interrelated with many others, and I shall not try to explain it. But it happens to illustrate a recent event in the history of linguistics, a subject on which I shall be even more sketchy than I was in the case of Euclid and Newton. Panini's grammar led to a vast output of works on grammar in different schools and with ramifications into other disciplines such as poetics. Grammar was in India the science of the sciences, and the number of works on grammar may be as large as that of all the other Indian sciences together. One reason is that all writers of Sanskrit studied Panini's grammar, or later incarnations such as the grammar of Chandra Gomin that Buddhist authors used. Panini is similar to Euclid also in another respect. Euclid had a great commentator, the Neoplatonist Proclus, who lived 7 centuries later. Panini had an even greater commentator, Patanjali, who lived 2 or 2.5 centuries later. Patanjali was not a slavish follower of Panini. He corrected him when it was necessary. He stated clearly that Sanskrit is infinite, a basic property of language that was implied by Panini's grammar, but never stated explicitly, since Panini left us nothing but the rules of his grammar. How am I doing for time? I lost the thread a little bit. Good story. That's why I asked, really. And you may prefer a story, I can omit something else. Why is Sanskrit infinite? Why is language infinite? Well, Patanjali tells the story of Indra, who wanted to, the king of the gods, of course, he wanted to learn Sanskrit. So what does he do? He asked the professor of the gods, Brihaspati, to come and explain it to him. And Brihaspati enumerates each correct form of Sanskrit. Might take one day, the next day he goes on. Na antam jagama, says Patanjali. He did not reach the end. What has to be done instead? It's not a joke, it's a very significant thing. what has to be done instead. Work has to be composed that consists of sutras and that includes the rules and the exceptions. You cannot go on enumerating. You have to get general statements, and those are the sutras. Indian linguistics was also influential in other Asian countries, especially in Tibet. In Europe, it led to Franz Bopp and the beginning of modern linguistics. Panini's witticism, I make a little jump, is repeated by the only other linguist who is of a similar stature, Noam Chomsky. Chomsky has never mentioned the name of Panini in any of his numerous writings, as far as I know. But the major work on phonology of the 1960s, a large volume that was written by Chomsky in cooperation with his closest colleague at MIT, Morris Halley, ends with a rule of the same form, ah. It doesn't mean the same at all as what it means in Panini. I would not be able to explain it, but it is a small bow to the Indian master that not every student of that very technical treatise will be able to appreciate. Chomsky is well known in India, and you may be familiar with his politics, if not his linguistics. When he returned from his first visit to this country, I asked him what did strike him most. He said without a moment of hesitation, the ease of access to the leaders of the government. I was immediately invited for lunch by Indira Gandhi, but would have to wait long, very long, or forever before I would be able to see US President, and he mentioned a name that I have forgotten. Well, I can imagine at least one reason. Chomsky is as clever as were Shakalia and Panini. I conclude that Panini's greatest contribution was the structural system of his grammar, which was based upon a unique method and led to deep generalizations, many of which are valid across languages and maybe linguistic universals. Insight in the infinity of language was part of that package. I must now change course and place early Indian grammar in the scientific context in which it belongs and fits most closely. And with that, I come to the, what was it called? Or are they? Where does it fit? And where does it belong? With the science of ritual. You may wonder whether there exists such a science and where it comes from. It is a large topic, and I don't have much time, but I shall treat one example, the notion of default. It is like the concept of meta rule, a feature of both the science of ritual and that of language. The two sciences share many other structural features. Incidentally, the science of ritual is called Kalpa, and it includes also the Shubha Sutras or geometry, but I'm not talking about that. The two sciences share these features, but it looks like that the ritual analysis in many cases preceded that of the grammarians, and that applies, I think, to the discovery of meta rules and default options both. The clearest account of the notion of default occurs in the Shrauta Sutra of Apastamba. The Apastambas lived on the banks of the Yamuna River in the region of Mathura during the Kuru period, about 1000 BC. But their Shrauta Sutra was composed further east and later, closer in time, to Panini. Apastamba singles out the default options for oblations, priests, and ritual implements. It specifies first that the default oblation is clarified butter. Juhotiti chodyamane sarpir ajam pratiyat. When it is said in the sutra, Juhoti, make this offering, then pratiyat, it means that it must be sarpir ajam, clarified butter. I shall continue to quote the Sanskrit so that you can see how brief some of these meta rules of ritual are. Not as brief as Panini's formulas, but not so lengthy either. They are sutras or paribhashas, meta rules. The meta rule on the default oblation means that if an oblation is prescribed, but it is not specified what it is an oblation of, it has to be assumed that it is an oblation of clarified butter. If an oblation of anything else, it will be stated explicitly, like a rice cake or something like that. The default priest is the advaryu, advaryum kartaram. That means that if a sutra says that he has to perform such and such an act, that he refers to the advaryu. If another priest has to perform an act, the name of his office will be specified. Among the ritual implements, the default implement is the juhu ladle. You know, these ladles are these long things made of wood. Juhum patram. There are degrees of default. When the juhu is already used and no other implement is specified, the oblation has to be made with the help of the shruva. Vyapratayam shruvena. You can imagine that that science had something to do with the science of grammar. Now Panini, the notion of multiple defaults comes in a famous metta rule, anabhihite. The following rules apply when it is not already expressed. It's a very abstract metta rule, and it refers to the karaka. Karaka relations are relations that are similar to that between subject and object, subject and indirect object, and so on. It's a very technical topic in any grammar, and certainly in that of Panini. There exists an extensive literature on karaka in the Sanskrit tradition, in modern Indian languages such as Hindi and Marathi, and probably many others, in English, French, German, Japanese, and so on. I shall not even attempt to explain it. All it shows is that the notion of default is an early notion that seems to have traveled from the science of ritual to that of language. And there is a technical term for it, anabhidhanam. Young Bangaloreans may be inclined to believe that the concept of default originated in Bangalore. They are partly right, since it happened in India, though not in Karnataka, but in Kosala or Videha, now eastern Uttar Pradesh and Bihar, north of the Ganges. That is, it happened at the eastern extremity of Vedic India and at the end of the Vedic period. Now, a little bit more about the or are they. The first is, of course, the thing that I already have, that I have just mentioned. There is not only on the Indian side one science, but there are two. So it is not a comparison between two sciences in two civilizations, but it is one of two in one civilization compared to one in the other. We have seen that Panini was preceded by clever Shakalya in the discipline of grammar. If the science of ritual is equally important, we are entitled to know the name of an equally clever ritualist. It is easy, for it can only be Baudhayana, who was far more important than Apastamba, since he was the author of the most detailed and authoritative of the ritual sutras. His name is the same as that of the author of the geometrical theorem that is also called after Pythagoras, for both Baudhayanas belong to the same Vedic school of that name, and their apparently personal name reflects that affiliation. In other words, they were not the same person. These additions amplify and complicate the system of the original thesis that Euclid is to Europe what Panini is to India. But there are other asymmetries in store, and I shall end with those. One is concerned with the position and status of the sciences we have considered within their respective traditions. The science of grammar or linguistics that was put on a firm foundation by Panini seems to constitute a unique event in the history of mankind. No other civilization has created anything similar until we come to modern linguistics, which was not only influenced by the Indian tradition, but would not exist without it. That's not my claim, that's generally agreed upon by linguists. We cannot say the same about the geometry of Euclid, because there was geometry before him and after him. But it does apply to his axiomatic method. So here we have a unique science on the one side and a unique method on the other. An interesting but an asymmetrical relationship. This particular asymmetry is related to another, and that one is the most interesting, I think. While the mathematician Euclid in Europe was not accompanied or followed by numerous systems of linguistics, the linguist Panini in India lived in a country that can boast of a great tradition of mathematicians. Apart from the Baudhayanas and their Vedic colleagues, I need only mention Aryabhatta and Brahmagupta, in addition to the extraordinary geniuses of Madhava in the 14th and Ramanujan in the 20th century. But India also made the anonymous contribution of the Indian numerals and the zero. These appeared elsewhere in the world in some form or other, but are in their Indian form an essential part of civilization. The natural order of the sounds of language, ka, ka, ga, and so on, was discovered in India and adopted and adapted in many writing systems of Asia, in Southeast Asia, in East Asia, in Central Asia, and so on. If it had also reached the Near East and Europe, there would not be so many irrational alphabets like the ABC, to which there is no rhyme or reason, and the modern world would have rational and practical Indian syllabaries along with rational and practical Indian numerals. We would like our life and our science to be simple, but it did not happen, for reality itself is sometimes a bit more messy than it appears to be at first. There may be more to it, but with these embellishments, I have explained the or are they part of the title, and I shall take my leave. Thank you. And of course, there's scope for questions. Or I walk around. Oh, yeah. Oh, I have to be. Yeah. I stand here. Yeah.
Well, another topic is open for discussion and comments.
Yes.
Yes.
Just 1 second. Okay. Professor, go ahead.
I wonder if the ritual science.
I think surveying is a historical precedent to Euclid, and the Greeks themselves said that about the Egyptians, as you know, Herodotus, I think. That, yes, yes. But then the surveying did not result into either an axiomatic system or a system like that of like Panini, while the science of ritual is a science of ritual which produced the Shrauta Sutras, which is a body of works that have the same rules, and they have meta rules, and they have meta linguistic markers, and they have all that stuff. The sutra style, in other words, which may have originated with Panini or may with the Shrauta Sutras, nobody really knows, that makes it into a science. And Newton's system of axioms and demonstrations, depending on them, makes it into a science more than the science of geodesics, or which existed before and which must have been highly developed. But about, do we have handbooks of it? The Egyptians may? We have. You know Needham's work on Chinese science. There is an illustration from Kalimantan, Borneo in Indonesia, and you see the Dayaks there who want to find out the position of the sun so that they can fix their agricultural calendar. And so they have to have a vertical pole. And how do they do it? Well, the pole is a pole, and then they have ropes, and the triangle is 3, 4, 5. And that was known, of course, well, I don't know how long ago. And then there were extensions, and of course, and then it was generalized. But it was never done in the form in which it is most familiar to us, namely as A square plus B square is equals C square. That came, more than 1,000 years later. Yes.
Whose task was more complex, Euclid's or Panini's, and how do you rate their achievements? And thirdly, as regards...
there was two questions. What is the third? Maybe I can combine them.
Yeah, the third one is, as regards further emendations or alternative systems developed. How do you compare Euclid and Ptolemy?
How do I compare Euclid and Ptolemy?
Yeah.
Well, let me think aloud. I haven't thought about this exactly. But Euclid was preceded by many grammarians who discovered many theorems, and they were known to him. So those grammarians used, not axioms, of course, that was Euclid's, but they certainly used what we, well, like the Shubha Sutras do. Now, the Shubha Sutras, I jump a little bit, but it is relevant to what you are asking. They don't have axioms, but they certainly use that one thing depends on another thing. For instance, if they want to construct, which is a thing which is very central to the Shubha Sutras, to Indian geometry of the Vedic period, if they want to construct a square equal in area to a given rectangle, they use the theorem of Pythagoras or Baudhayana, and they know that they're using it, they refer to it. So in other words, the idea of deriving one proposition from another one was much more widespread in the world than the idea of deriving all propositions from axioms. So that is something that led up to it. How did they think of it? How did they get to it? Well, in the case of geometry, starting with geodesic, with making these vertical, you can get some idea and the knowledge of 3, 4, 5. 3, 4, 5, we also don't know. It's not necessarily that it was thought of as a triangle. It could merely be known that 3 square plus 4 square is 5 square. And there might have been another triple that was known for, what is the next one? 4 and 5 doesn't go well. Maybe there was one before. Anyway, now, is that difficult? Yes, of course it's all difficult. But if it is spread out over a number of communities and centuries and countries that were in touch with each other, like the Greeks and the Mesopotamians and the Egyptians, it is not so surprising. And about Ptolemy, I have traced some of the steps. It starts with that mouth. With the Vedic system of sounds. That was a major discovery that nobody had thought of. Once you think of it, it is pretty obvious. But there are many people who don't understand it. In Asia also, this idea was accepted reluctantly in many places. It was almost accepted for Arabic by one Arabic grammarian, but he couldn't convince the others, but he understood it immediately. And he put his finger in his mouth to feel where a sound exactly is produced. And we know that because the Arabic records are quite explicit on these things. We don't know anything where Ptolemy put his finger, but it is quite possible that he did and that clever Shakalia did it before him. How do you get into that idea? Well, the reciters of the Veda had to preserve the Veda. They had to preserve the form of the Veda as was required for the ritual, not the meaning. And so they separated the form from the meaning. And you must separate those. If you don't separate those from each other, you cannot remember the exact form. For instance, you would replace Agni by Vanhi. Agni means fire and Vanhi means also fire. But the mantra requires Agni. It doesn't tolerate even Vanhi. It would be a mistake if you would put in there Vanhi. You must not know the meaning if you are a ritualist. That facilitated the concentration on form. And the concentration on form is essential if you want to write a grammar. Of course, you also need semantics. And Ptolemy has a lot about semantics. But he is not complete on semantics, and actually I think there's no grammar that is complete on semantics so far, though we have good dictionaries. Yes.
This is not a question, but just a clarification I want. The concept of stoba, which you are talking about from the point of view of Vedic, and especially from Samavedic point of view, Is it the same as that of the concept of stoba when we define a sutra, or do they differ?
Astoba. Yeah. Well, astoba is not a stoba, so we must first look at what is a stoba. A stoba is the following. Agna ayahi vitaye is the beginning of Samaveda. Agna ayahi vitaye. Agni come here to the sacrificial feast, to the feast. Agna ayahi vitaye. Agna ayahi. That is changing the Rigvedic Agna ayahi vitaye into the Samavedic form, and there you have stobas. Ayahi, ayahi, ayahi. Those are stobas. And some of those stobas are very interesting. Pum, 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 pum is a stoba, and so on. So those are stobas, and that can be translated as embellishment. You find it in music. In music, you often have to follow a melody, and this shows that, I think, that they often followed pre-existing melodies. And lots of other things follow from that. But you should not have a sutra that suddenly says, Iko Yanachi. No, you cannot do that. This is a scientific statement. You can also not have a formula in which you suddenly have some music. F equals M times I. No, that you don't do. So that is why the definition of sutra contains the expression astobham. It should not be a stoba.
Then,
does that answer your question?
Yeah, yeah. If we take the same stand regarding this particular mantra, etat samaga jannaste ha bhuha. Is it astoba or stoba in that particular fashion?
Habu is a stoba.
That is stoba.
The triple repetition of habu is three stobas. And you do it beautifully.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Please begin.
Could you tell us, please, if the sacred say syllable om,
right,
is it mentioned by Panini?
Ah, no, I don't think so. It certainly existed, and he must have been familiar with it, but he doesn't mention it. But he doesn't mention any stova in his grammar. But he mentions forms of the Veda, of the Vedic language. He is not complete, but he has a number of sutras which are called Chandasi in the Veda, and then he gives a variant to the ordinary Sanskrit. And that is another reason to believe that he was a Vedic Brahmin, because he quotes from not just from one Veda, but from many different Vedas. I mean, he was more than a Vedic Brahmin in the sense that he also obtained information about other Vedas. He doesn't mention Om. But then Om does it belong to ordinary spoken Sanskrit of his time? That is also a question, but Om is certainly a stoba, and I think it is a stoba also. It occurs, where does it occur early? In these prefixes to the Upanishads, like the Taittiriya Upanishad, it occurs. But it doesn't occur in Panini. That I know for sure. Those Vedic sutras, I don't know, because they are not complete, and why he should have done it, or why he and the commentators don't Patanjali doesn't say anything about those Chandasi sutras. And it has no accent like that. It should be like a stick. It should be recited without accent. And you may know the text. Prabhu vaja abhidhavo If I start thinking, I don't know it. Prabho vaja abhidyavo avishvanto grata cha devanji gati sumnayo. There you have the Om. No, no, it is a ritual thing, yes. Some parts of it, but it comes in what you refer to in the Ashvalayana Shraddha Sutra and in Shankayana. Well, thank you.
You see that this, the...
You are after Om.
Well, I'm trying to focus attention on another aspect of it. The Jains adopted this. The first letters of the Arhantas, all the five masters, the first letter is taken to constitute the Om. Mm. And they are the Panchapadas. When in the pranava, in the Jain system, when one takes this lekhana, he has to utter all the five and continue to utter it till his death. But when his voice fails, see, then he can only utter the first letter, not the entire sentence. Then if the voice fails, he has to utter only the first letter. And if you take the first letter of all the pancha, the five teachers, it winds up as Om. So that was also borrowed by, it was borrowed or invented, whatever it is. The Jains claim that they invented it. See. That's why I asked, is there any sort of truth in this one? You see, or was it a common thing for both the Jains and the Hindus?
You know, of course, but there are many theories about it. And one theory you would be interested in, John Marr at SOAS, he wrote, is it John Marr? I think so. Anyway, no. It was Asko Papola, whom you may also know. He wrote that Om comes from Dravidian and that it is the same as Tamil Ama. Or what do you say in Tamil? You say yes. It means yes. And of course, I think it's unlikely. And I also don't know how old is Ama in Tamil. Do you know that? Is it?
Ama means yes in Tamil, but it is Am. That is, it's Am twice.
Am.
Yeah. Am means yes. Am means.
But if you hear Tamil speaking, then sometimes one says Ama.
Ama, so, Ama.
Oh, you have to say twice? How old is it in Tamil? But you find it in Sangam Tamil. You don't find conversation in... No. Now these Shastras are older than 2nd century BC. I think one can safely say.
In Sanskrit also, in Bhasa.
What Partha?
Dramas.
Oh, I see. I see. By in the Prakrit or in the Sanskrit?
No, in Sanskrit.
In the Sanskrit. I don't know.
Senses, the concept of womb has been uttered in Mankha Kosha, which is one of the koshas, which is a standard kosha. Abhyudane Abhyupagame, in giving charities and taking charities. Tushnim Bhave, in keeping quiet. Samarchane, in offering puja. And on all auspicious occasions, one can chant Om.
And what is this Mankha Kosha?
That is one of the koshas like Amara Kosha.
I see.
Like a lexicon.
Yeah, yeah.
We have got different koshas, Halayuda Kosha, Mankha Kosha, so on and so forth. And there he gives the six uses of chanting the concept of Om. And Shankara Bhashya directly states that in all auspicious occasions, on the Sutra Atato Brahmajignasa, Shankara's Bhashya is there. On that, Ratna Prabha has given a further commentary wherein he says that Om is as auspicious as Brahman himself because it has come from the mouth of Brahman.
ओंकारश्चात शब्दश्च द्वावेतौ ब्रह्मणपुरा कंठं बित्वा विनिर्यातौ तस्मान् मांगलिका उभौ. दिस इज रत्नप्रभा कमेंट्री ऑन शंकर भाष्य ऑफ द फर्स्ट ब्रह्म सूत्र अथातो ब्रह्म जिज्ञास. एंड इवन इन तैत्तिरीय उपनिषद वी हैव गॉट लॉट द एंटायर अध्याय इज बेंट ऑन ओम. ओमिति ब्रह्म ओमितीदगं सर्वं ओमित्येतदनुकृतिहस्मव अप्योश्रावयेत्याश्रावयन्ति ओमिति सामानि गायन्ति ओगुं शोमिति शस्त्राणि शगं सन्ति ओमित्यध्वर्यु प्रतिकरं प्रतिगृणाति ओमिति ब्रह्म प्रसौति. सो वी हैव एन एंटायर पैसेज इन तैत्तिरीय उपनिषद. And even in right from Vedic times, I have got lots of usages of Om in all its manifestations. Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been a wonderful evening for us, and we are all familiar with the names of Euclid, Panini, and Patanjali. But I think we got exposed to quite a lot of their real work, and I must thank Professor Fritz Stahl. This excellent presentation, and also the young man there for adding some interesting addition to the wonderful lecture given by Professor Stahl. Thank you all.
Thank you.